Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Glad you could be here. My name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to be bringing you today's webinar on what you need to know to come out on top, the B2B edition. So much has changed in the world during the past few months, but the more they change, the more they stay the same, they say. Today, we've got a panel of leading commercial collection executives who are here to discuss a number of important topics. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, offers a number of exciting podcasts, and manages a Slack channel for the credit collection industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it's got to offer. Now let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Sharon Carmelli has more than 14 years of experience practicing law and working with private and public companies. As Chief Compliance Officer and General Counsel at Bluevine, a successful fintech offering online funding solutions and financial services to SMBs, Sharon built robust compliance management systems, regulatory monitoring, and comprehensive policies and procedures to support Bluevine's growth. Mark Edwards is the Managing Director of CreditSafe USA and a registered global credit professional with a history in business information. He has years of experience in portfolio management, credit and risk solutions, and business development. Katie Beach has more than a decade of experience and a proven track record working in the logistics industry. Most recently, she was held the role of Vice President, building out a new division for InsideArm. She's a five-time winner of her organization's special recognition for outstanding performance. And when she's not out educating companies on how to reduce their credit losses without sacrificing sales and increased revenues, Katie spends her time with her husband and daughter at home in Pennsylvania. Dan North has been with Euler Hermes North America since 1996, using macroeconomic and quantitative analysis to help manage Euler's risk portfolio of more than $150 billion in annual U.S. trade transactions. After having predicted the 2008-2009 recession and its implications accurately, he was ranked fourth on Bloomberg's list of the 65 top economic forecasters. Mr. North holds an MBA from the Wharton School of Business. Ray Peloso is president and CEO of Katabat and sits on Katabat's board of directors. He brings 25 years of diverse consumer lending experience, having held executive leadership roles at RBS, Capital One, Citibank, and MBNA. Ray's prior expertise in consumer credit and leading and lending underpins a clear vision and understanding of the challenges faced by Katabat's clients in today's rapidly evolving digital economy. The format for today's webinar is going to be a mini presentation from Dan and then a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. With that, let me turn the presentation over to Katie to kick things off. Katie?
Thanks, Mike. So Dan, we're going to start off with you. So what are you seeing? What are you hearing? What is your personal perspective on the state of the state today? And I know you've got a presentation to kick us off.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Katie. And I'm very pleased to be here. I am going to go over the U.S. economy, bringing the slides up here, and presentation view. There we go. So I am going to talk about the U.S. economy. I've got a lot to cover in 10 minutes. I won't get everything everybody would like to hear. I do just want to point out, you know, who we are and where I come from. I'm from Euler Hermes. We're the world's largest provider of trade credit insurance. We've been around for 125 years. We're AA rated by S&P. Got offices in 52 countries. We're owned by the Allianz Group. And we have 52,000 clients worldwide, insuring $1 trillion of sales globally. Very briefly, that's who we are in the world of trade credit insurance. I do want to start off this afternoon by talking about COVID-19, because that is actually driving everything as we know. And there are lots of things to look at, but here are the two simplest things. These are the growth rates here in the U.S. of cases and deaths. And you can see clearly we are bending the curve down. This is a good thing, obviously. We've had a little bit of a stumble in the past couple of days, but I really believe that just as the evidence shows, we will continue to be on the downturn. Nonetheless, policy over the past, number of months in the US and everywhere else has been driven by COVID, and the response has been, shut down businesses and tell everybody to stay home. So we knew that the economy was going to look bad, but most of the economic data that economists look at is issued monthly, and it's kind of with a lag. But one thing is, and it's called weekly jobless claims. So we knew when things were starting to really go bad in March that it would show up in this data. And that's the chart on the left. That's a 50-year chart. And you can see there across the bottom, that's 50 years worth of data and the last few weeks. On average, 350,000 people a week go in the unemployment insurance office and say, I got laid off, I need my benefits. Well, in March, we didn't get 350,000 or 750,000 or a million. We got 3.3 million, almost 10 times as much in a single week. And if you look at the chart on the right, you can see the devastation to the economy. This shows the cumulative number of jobs created since the Great Recession. So on the left, we go back here to 2009 and follow the blue line. We had built 5, 10, 15, 20, 23 million jobs created in the 10 years since the Great Recession, and they're all wiped out in 5 weeks. So clearly we're doing something, we are involved in something that is completely different. It's not really unprecedented, it's completely different. Now, fortunately, if we look at the past 16 weeks or so of jobless claims, you can see that we are actually on trending down. We're still at astronomical levels, but trending down. If we look at the chart on right, this is what we call continuing claims. This is the number of people who are still getting unemployment benefits. Well, they started to drop last week, which suggests that people actually are going back to work. So this is very positive news. Nonetheless, the number of people out of work, as I say, it's not just unprecedented, it's completely different. And as a result, people have stopped spending money. Well, personal spending runs 70% of the economy. And that chart over there on the left, that's personal spending back 60 years. You can see the last two months, what an enormous record we've set compared to the previous record. I mean, it doesn't really compare at all. Good news is, I think that may have bottomed out. We had two really, really bad months, and I think that that's probably the bottom. Now on the right, we've got corporate profits. You can see that red line there. It's not quite the record. It's the second biggest. That's not bottomed out. So as a result, we're going to start to see, or continue to start to see, consumer delinquencies over there on the left. For instance, you can see auto delinquencies. This is the dollar amount of loans that are delinquent going up to, 40 to 60 billion. Auto loans are climbing. Green line credit cards going up. The biggest part of consumer debt, student debt going up. And we expect to continue to see that up. And on the right is the number of business bankruptcy filings as opposed to the consumer bankruptcies. You can see that business bankruptcies since the end of the Great Recession have steadily declined because, relatively speaking, the economy was growing, so things were better for bankruptcies. We don't think this year, pretty sure the bankruptcies are going to go up 25%, which is a pretty sharp increase. Now, it's not a great situation. Obviously, we're going to see this Friday another huge employment report showing, another 10 million people out of work. But it's not hopeless either. We've got some evidence up here across the top showing that the housing market actually is poised for a rebound. That chart on the left shows an index of mortgage applications, and each line is a different year, and the blue line is us, 2020 right now. Geez, it's higher than it's been in 10 years. Very strong. On the right is a chart that is a Google search for new homes, and that's been climbing recently. And down there on the left are three other things. You know, hotel occupancy has bottomed out, dining has bottomed out, and credit card transactions have bottomed out as well. So it's not hopeless. We have a few tough months to get through. So the forecast is for a U-shaped recovery. We expect that the second quarter of this year is going to be down 30% quarter over quarter. It's the worst since the Great Depression. However, we do expect also to see a rebound in Q3 and Q4. So that's this sort of U-shaped recovery we expect to see. And in a way, it's really kind of, it makes sense, you know. We turn the economy off, we should be able to put it back on so we can get this recovery going easily, right? We can just put the lights back on, we can just reopen, right? Sort of. It's not quite that simple. There are some impediments, some downside risk to this U-shaped recovery. We could have a COVID resurgence. We clearly have social unrest right now. And more importantly, we have a situation where we thought the economy would open back up really rapidly. Maybe not so much. And here are a couple reasons why. I mean, employers and consumers are not going to be returning as fast as we thought. Now, this chart on the left, I know you can't read it, but I can explain it pretty easily. Each horizontal line is a different state. So the top state across there is Maine. These gray dots on the left show the percentage of wages that are replaced by typical unemployment benefits. And in Maine, that's like 45%. Well, with the CARES Stimulus Act, people who are on unemployment get an extra $600 a week. And that drives those gray dots over to the right to those green dots. So for instance, in Maine now, your unemployment benefits pay 135% of wages. In other words, in Maine, it makes more sense for people to stay at home and collect unemployment, and it'll remain that way through the end of July. And in fact, that's the case for 37 states, the 37 green dots that are to the right of that vertical line. People will make more money by staying home. So, you know, that's going to be an impediment to for people to come back. And at the same time, we have over on the right consumer surveys, and I've seen a lot of these showing that consumers really quite aren't that comfortable yet going back out. So for instance, this top box in the upper left asking, are you comfortable going out to eat? Well, 25% in this green, the dark green said, okay, I would do that in the next month. Well, another 24% said, yeah, I'm probably going to wait 2 or 3 months. Another 16% said, yeah, no, I'm going to wait 6 months. In other words, the majority of people asked in this survey say they're not ready to go out to eat, to go to a shopping mall, go to the gym, that sort of thing. So we're getting a response from both employees and consumers that's not as rapid as we would like. Let me just quickly wrap up here. Obviously, COVID-19 has caused us and the rest of the world to shut down our economies, and the result has been some of the worst measures since the Great Depression. Consumption, 70% of the economy is drying up. We're going to see increased delinquencies and bankruptcies. We should be able to open back up. Things aren't hopeless, but we do have some downside risks, some impediments to those, to that U-shaped recovery. Thank you very much for listening, and I'm going to hand it back off to Katie. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Dan. I really appreciate that, and I know everybody else does. Mark, I could tell you've got some thoughts going, so I'll go over to you. Do you have some questions for Dan?
I think he's muted.
There you go. Thank you, Dan. That was a fascinating presentation. One of the things that caught my eye was the slide about business-to-business bankruptcy.
Yeah.
It's a multi-part question, I guess.
Okay.
Does this refer to the actual legal process of bankruptcy and not business closure? And what would be the source of that data?
Correct. It is actually bankruptcy filings.
Yeah, okay.
And the source is the administration offices of the U.S. courts where the bankruptcies are filed.
Do you have any forecasts on business closure from a business-to-business information provider? We obviously get a lot of questions around bankruptcy is one way a company would cease to trade, but a lot of companies are just shuttering their doors. Do you have any forecasts on that?
I don't have anything quantitative. I will give a couple of very brief qualitative examples. I think it's going to be really hard. I mean, restaurants are trying to open back up. They're going to be running at 50% capacity, and they've been running at 10% capacity for a while. Retail stores have to go through elaborate procedures to keep the number of customers from limited from coming in and clean up all the dressing rooms and the bathrooms every hour, that sort of thing. So it's going to be, I think, a real burden on businesses trying to keep going. I don't have a quantitative number for you.
No, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you both. Ray, just, lots to digest there and just curious kind of what your perspective is.
Yeah, thanks, Katie. Gosh, there's so many different ways you could go here. So if I could summarize everything I'm hearing and speaking to folks in the marketplace, it's this massive amount of uncertainty. So almost every model, every assumption, every piece of data that you've relied upon for years, if not decades of decision-making, you can actually throw out the window. So there's just a degree of massive uncertainty that I'm not sure anybody has been able to factor into decision-making. And at the exact moment that I think most leaders are trying to figure out where and how to be decisive. And so it's like standing on quicksand, but knowing that if you stand still, it's going to get really, really problematic. So when we listen to the marketplace and our clients and our prospects, what we're hearing a lot of is, where can I make what are basically no regrets decisions? How can I step forward and at least begin to mitigate and tamp out the larger effects? Because there's very little you can rely upon now. I think the presentation was fantastic. I saw a data point the other day that the U.S. savings rate has never been higher. I'm sure Dan knows that. So out of nowhere, the U.S. a consumer is now a saver, and it's precisely because they can't spend. They can't go out and spend. So who knows 3 or 5 months from now how this will evolve. But having said that, what we're seeing is a tremendous amount of shift in, and we're primarily consumer, but we've got some business clients as well, from revenue generation and growth, like a massive overnight shift to credit risk management and default. So that's sort of unambiguous from our perspective.
Go ahead, Dan.
Well, it's you make a number of spot on commentary there. As an economist, I've had this wonderful presentation developed, and I update it and add in new material to make a better story or a more accurate story. That all went out the window. It all suddenly became irrelevant. So for me, it's been a challenge. It's totally unlike what a lot of the, businesses that are facing, but you're right. The point is, everything that came before is meaningless now. You made a number of comments. I wasn't sure whether you actually had a question for me in there or not.
I did not.
Okay.
So Sharon, I'd like you to chime in. Kind of what have you done to adjust your operations post-COVID at this point?
Sure. So first of all, thank you, Dan. That was fascinating. Really, really impressive. And maybe the first thing that I want to touch on is somewhat related to your presentation, which is the PPP program, right? And the Main Street Lending Program. And here in Bluevine, what we quickly realized when this whole thing started is that our SMBs need two things. One, they need a pause in payments. And essentially what we did is deferred payment to a very, very large portion of our portfolio, understanding that those clients need some time to adjust. They do not have any activity, no revenue coming in, and we don't want to force them into default. It's not going to serve us. It's not going to serve them. So that was kind of the first thing we realized. The second thing we realized and moved very quickly on is access to PPP funds. So within a week or so, we were able to put together a new product altogether, an automated product for the most part, which allows those clients, our portfolio client, but also a lot of SMBs out there, to reach out to us, fill in an application within a few minutes, and receive an approval from the SBA, something that we're super proud of, and hopefully can help them to avoid that bankruptcy rate. Now, I think it also highly depended upon any changes that will come into effect for the CARES Act and whether or not forgiveness would be adjusted, and whether or not those SMBs could actually use the funds in different ways that were originally designated for those funds. But depending on those changes, I think we may see a slight decrease in this level of bankruptcy rate. But again, super interesting, and thank you for sharing this.
My pleasure.
Absolutely. So, you know, curious, Mark, on your side, has COVID-19 highlighted any gaps or deficiencies you're willing to share, you know, i.e. hiring for X role or creating a new role as a result?
I think the comment that Ray made about sort of being studying quicksand and sort of strikes a chord here. I think it's too early for us to be making decisions on what roles we need to be changing. The biggest sort of, I don't want to use the word gap or deficiency. I think area of opportunity is from an operations standpoint. How do we switch from an office-based company to working from home, which is going to be the new norm. And how does our IT and technology department support that? So I think, you know, from my perspective, the any gaps or deficiency are how do we support the what I think is going to be the new norm of certainly a very high percentage of working from home versus office-based.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I appreciate those insights. Sharon, question for you. What changes are you guys making as far as, you know, in response to the current state for whether credit policy, line of business, et cetera?
Yes. So we really need to tighten the credit box, to be honest. These are unprecedented times, a lot of uncertainty. It's very difficult for us to rely on our old models. I think that one of the first thing that we need to look at is new data that relates to the time in business, data that relates to states and how much of an opening do we see in those states, data with respect to number of employees. But in the thing that we didn't look at in the past so much, but we do look at today, is industry. Industry in the time of uncertainty becomes much more valuable. You want to take a deep look at your portfolio and understand who's more likely to survive that, or what type of services are more likely to become a commodity as opposed to before. So I guess this is the most material change that we're doing right now, which is adjusting the models with new data.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think there's a lot of people, right? You were nodding your head a lot. Do you want to add into that topic? I know you've got a lot of that banking background.
I've been out of the credit game for a while. I was nodding in agreement with the comment Sharon was making.
Yeah, I was expecting that response. I was expecting it. Ray, how have you adjusted your operations post-COVID? Any major changes?
You know, we are fortunate to be a technology company. We've been using collaboration tools for quite a number of years, and we coincidentally, we're going through an office move through all of this. And so we had to do some disaster recovery planning, et cetera. So our business continuity planning. So it's actually been not very difficult for our team. We've got engineers, QA, product managers. So I think we're in a kind of a, probably a different business structure than many on this call.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Actually, we have a question and my sources are telling me to ask it. So what was the month that the peak credit card under 90 days happened? The person thinks they may have missed that. So Dan, I think that's for you. What was the month of the peak credit card? I said over 90 days would happen.
I don't know. I'd have to go back and look into the historical data, because after the Great Recession, Americans really pared down their credit card risk. And it's only, been recently things have, delinquencies have started to crawl back up. They're going back up a little bit more rapidly now, and we expect to see more of that. The delinquencies, I think the peak delinquencies, and I'd have to go look, were back in the previous recession. And I'm not sure if that answers where we're getting.
Hey, Dan, it's Ray. It's all publicly available data. The St. Louis Fed publishes. It's pretty easy to extract and download. So Mike or Katie, you can even push it out to everybody. We monitor that data. It's probably 2009-ish timeframe. It's probably when it peaked.
Cool. Well, I think, again, the state of the state was great kickoff. Mark, I'm going to kick it back over to you. CreditSafe came to market first with that COVID impact score. Can you talk to us about what the COVID impact score is and who's using it today?
Yeah, absolutely. So coincidentally, I think you guys have also touched upon the need for new data. So I think this is sort of quite apt or a nice segue into that. CreditSafe basically tries to predict the likelihood of a company becoming bankrupt or delinquency in the next 12 months. So we sell a service that allows companies to do a credit report on a potential or existing vendor. During this time, it became evident that using historical data to look forward is not necessarily going to be appropriate during these times, or not appropriate, but we needed something else to enhance the model that was there. I really liked your comment, Dan, about this is not unprecedented, this is completely different. And we were thankfully very quick to sort of look at the idea of what other data exists to be able to help our customers. So another thing that really sort of impressed me was a comment by my boss, Matthew Devich, who sort of said, tasked the team with creating this score. The actions that we take now are what we're going to be remembered for. So the COVID impact score is data that we've analyzed that looks at how impacted a particular industry is going to be. We've looked at macro and microeconomic data, local government data, trade payment information on a particular industry, and seeing how that industry is affected, sorry, and then combining that with our credit risk score to produce a quadrant, essentially, and allows a company to look at a portfolio and treat different quadrants differently. So in the bottom right hand, you might have high risk and high impact, COVID impact, and then in the top right, sorry, you would have low risk and low impact. The COVID impact review allows you then to mitigate any risks, secure other business opportunities, and identify areas that we can grow. Determine any immediate actions, so quickly identify which are bad, which are good, or potentially good, and then create insights to develop a credit continuity plan.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate all those insights. So Dan, I think one of the questions I have for you is, what other scores or metrics, red flags, should the B2B world be looking at? We just heard from CreditSafe about the COVID impact score. What are other flags that they think they should be looking at?
From an economist point of view, I think I talked about a number of them. from our own typical experience in Euler-Hermes, what we've looked at for, what we look at every month is past due reporting. You know, our clients all tell us as part of the policy, who's paying them late, how late are they, how much past due they are. That gives us a pretty strong leading indicator of future, obviously of future claims activity, but it gives us a strong indicator of what's actually happening on the ground. We actually saw those going up pretty sharply last year. And you know, it wasn't really a surprise in the sense that what I was looking at from economic data made perfect sense that past dues were going to start increasing. And they did. And in my mind, the economy was, everybody thought it was fine. It was fragile enough under the surface that it just needed one thing to collapse. And COVID-19 was the one gigantic thing. Generally speaking, and this isn't my my area of expertise, but from our clients, you know, when somebody is paying, you know, that you've paid, has been paying perfectly for a long time, then says, hey, you know, an order didn't come in, or I didn't get a payment, can you give me an extra few days? And then doesn't again, well, that maybe is something to think about, or can you give me a bigger credit line? That's kind of a signal as well. So, you know, those are kind of the clues that you would look for. You know, bigger credit line, give me a bigger credit line now before I have to default on you. That's kind of the data that we try and pick up on. It's, you know, how, if, when payment degrades, increases in credit lines, those kinds of variables. So when we see that, we have to turn risk appetite down.
Great. Ray, I saw you nodding your head quite a bit on that. Do you have some more insights?
Maybe a form of a question for Sharon or Dan. It seems to me you've got the triple whammy potentially of pandemic in disproportionate impact to urban areas. So I live in the greater New York area. So I, you know, New York City obviously is very close to me. And then you could be in a certain industry like hospitality or gaming. And then your third strike now is these awful riots going on. So I do wonder whether, like, Sharon or a credit expert could really begin to triangulate in very concentrated ways for businesses at risk, very unique in the circumstances we're in right now.
I think, you know, we're definitely looking at where the business is located. I'll say that. At the same time, what Bluevine is proud of is actually being able to serve those small businesses that are in more rural areas that do not have access to banks, that do not have access to financing otherwise. Serving minorities, serving the underserved. And I think that, you know, although we will target in our new models, understanding better where the risk lays, I think that it will not affect us the way that, you know, you may be imagining. I hope so, at least. But there's so much uncertainty. I don't know how I would respond to this question next week. Maybe Dan can do a better job here.
I'm not sure that I can. That's, again, it's kind of out of my realm as a macro economist. I think you're much closer to it. So throw me a macro softball and I can manage.
I like that response. Ray, before I open this next question up to the group, I'd like to start with you. How are you leveraging technology or plan to, you know, leverage technology post-COVID? Obviously, we know that Catabat's got some great technology, but I'm sure you yourself are using it as well.
Yeah, I might kind of pivot my comments to maybe how the audience might use it, because we're a technology company to begin with, but
sure.
The direction of travel in general is microservices, open source, and so it opens up a lot of different flexibilities for users of technology and purchasers. And so for us, I'll give you one example. Many of you may know that working having call center agents work from home all of a sudden became a requirement essentially overnight. And so we've got products and the ability to deliver a desktop into the home. And so for us, from a product roadmap and investment perspective, those are examples of the kinds of things we're thinking about on our product roadmap, because demand, we think, in the marketplace has fundamentally shifted. But I'm thinking for the audience listening to this call, my experience is that there's actually a ton of great technology out there. And more often than not, and in my experience the last 90 days, more often than not, it's internal decision-making processes and governance and evaluation analysis. So human things have been more of an obstacle than actual technology. So I really liked Sharon's opening comments. I think for the most part, if a business leader makes a choice to go pursue a strategy in the marketplace, you can actually find great technology out there to support that decision. So I don't think technology itself is the obstacle. There's actually tremendous technologies out there in the space.
Yeah, Sharon, I think that's a great question for you as well. How are you guys leveraging technology or planning to leverage technology post-COVID?
Yeah, that is a great question. And I fully agree with that, with Ray. One thing that comes to mind is, and I hope I can say this word, I have trouble pronouncing it, digitization. And that's something that we've seen a lot of, especially around the PPP. As you know, the PPP program required the lenders to verify a number of documents that are otherwise traditional tax forms, like 491, like Schedule C, things of that sort. Having the ability to process those documents in an automated way and verifying from my information automatically instead of on a manual basis allowed us to service a greater deal of customers in a much shorter time. So that's like one example that is very important. Another example is having an adjustable platform, right? So as a company that is serving small businesses, our platform was designed to service lending customers with specific product. The ability to adjust it quickly such that it can serve a new whole product within a week that has different requirement, different verification standards, different documents to review is super important. And this will continue over time, right? We will need to adjust our product in accordance with how the economy changes. And lastly, that, you know, it's technology, but it also relates to all of the things that I've said before, continue to enhance automation. Automation is something that a technology company cannot do without, a lending company in these, you know, in this day and age cannot do without, but the ability to adjust it such that you would constantly recognize attempts for fraud, you would constantly adjust the underlying parameters that you're using to make credit decision. This is all critical. I think these three items are the most important things that we rely on and we use in our decision making.
Yeah, and I definitely appreciate those thoughts. You know, while we're staying on that topic, so one of the things that I think is very prominent for businesses, especially today, is how and when do you consider building versus buying new technology? What's Bluevine doing today, or what are you guys considering when looking at new technology versus building in-house?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it's an ROI question. I'm sure an economist would be able to opine better here, but generally speaking, it's always better to build something for your own company, something that fits well with your existing system, something that you can adjust easily, and something that is basically proprietary to you. However, not every build is justifiable from an ROI perspective. So this is a trade-off that we're constantly doing when deciding whether or not to develop something ourselves or to use an open source like Ray said or something of that sort.
Hey, yeah. Katie, just more probably an editorial comment, and I've granted I'm probably a little bit biased in my point of view, but I always love the story of Disney World. Disney World has, you know, millions of interactions for somebody coming to visit. And they've spent decades honing the 26 moments of truth that matter, and they invest disproportionately in those 26 moments of truth. So to build on Sharon's comment, my point to our clients and prospects is know what you're good at and how you drive unique value to your clients in your market. And if that includes building technology, by all means do it, but be clear-eyed about it, because if your core company mission is to provide products or services and technology is not your core mission, I think we're in an era of specialization of technology. And my view is that will continue, not reverse. And so the sort of the larger institutions that have built up proprietary technology over decades, not just a couple of years, I think find it hard to make the pivots necessary at moments like this, because they can't just go out into the marketplace and grab a specialized product. So we have this conversation a lot with our clients in the pipeline and our prospects.
Yeah, I appreciate those insights, you know, and one of the things that I've heard and I've seen recently is kind of the tech side of things is we can build it, but it's going to take twice as long. And so something that may take a year to implement out of the gates with, you know, taking it off the shelf or buying something you can customize is going to take 3 years, because we're going to build it in-house. And by the end of it, we may not even have the product still, but we have something like the product. And so, you know, I agree with your sentiments, and I would say that one of the things I worry about is people waiting and saying that they're going to build it. And this comes from experience in a past position where we built the technology, but it took us 5 years to build it. And it's something we probably could have bought off the shelf in 2.5. So I appreciate those thoughts. All right. So keeping on the technology question, Ray, maybe I'll stick with you on this. So what's, you know, most exciting on the horizon from technology perspective? What are you guys working on behind the scenes? Are you willing to share the secret sauce?
Dan may opine on a macro level. I think the macro thesis of intelligence, you know, the phrase artificial intelligence is way overly broad and not appropriately used, but the ability to bring automation, robotic process automation, machine learning, and sort of bringing the machine to bear into the workforce is, it's fraught with risk. So if you don't have a really clear idea around what you're going to go build and why you're going to go build it, you can just sort of build stuff. But there's no question, like our view of the direction of travel is bring the right activities to the right human being with that unique skill set, and take those repetitive tasks and activities and just figure out a really robust, well-controlled, repeatable way to automate those. I mean, I think these are probably pretty obvious comments, but we invest in trying to bring those kind of products to our clients so that they can, again, bring like the really value-add activities to that really well-trained employee by removing the repetitive things. And I think that's probably a pattern that everybody in this call has been thinking about and talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'd be curious, Mr. Edwards, Mark, so how are you adapted your go-to strategy to kind of better reflect the current state? Have you guys changed your go-to strategy? Mark, you might be on mute still. Gotta love the mute button.
The more webinars and more Zoom calls I do, for whatever reason, I seem to be getting worse at using it.
Me too, don't worry.
the very early in, as this pandemic was building, around March the 20th, we have European offices that were closing, and I think we were speaking to these on a daily basis, so we kind of had the heads up that something real was coming. So we were speaking to various people, and one of the things that was evident was people are really looking for guidance during this time. And that was our sort of guiding principle, is what guidance can we provide in the business-to-business credit information space? And we really sort of focused then on, you know, making sure that our actions were appropriate for during the time. Credit Sage is probably, you know, a fairly aggressive telesales organization. We do have field sales, but primarily maybe 60% of our business is outdoor in telesales environment. And, you know, people just don't want to be called upon right now to be offered a service they might not even want. So we adapted our strategy and offered free tools. It was important for us that, you know, we wanted to get the message out there that we wanted to support US businesses. And it was important for us to tell the story that we don't want people just making knee-jerk reactions and just removing all credit, because that's just going to further damage the economy. So doing so in a sensible way, but to do so in a sensible way, they need access to tools. So we created programs that essentially gives any US business access to our services free of charge. From a renewal aspect, any customer that was unable to renew with us because of COVID-related events, obviously lots of our customers had to furlough staff. It was important that they didn't lose any services, so we extended their agreements for 3 months, hopefully enough time to see them through the worst of this. But also by improving or adding more content to our website, so very similar to what you're doing, Katie, just putting interesting and informative content out there, whether that be on products that companies may not be using to their full capacity, or just having a conversation with industry experts to get a feel for what's going on.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Right. I'd be curious kind of for you to chime in on the same topic. What have you guys done to adapt your go-to-market strategy?
Because our products are particularly useful in recessionary in the economy, we've actually gotten really aggressive. And so we're doing more of everything is probably the first thing I would say. But the twist we're putting on it, which I feel really strongly about, is we're actually trying to go out and help certainly the small business segment. So we've been going out with a program to help small business prospects basically work through this period. So we've been deferring any costs until late this year into next year. So I think our team has kind of rallied around our products really matter right now. And actually we're not driving, you know, to grab money and grab profits. We're actually trying to help our clients do well by their customers during this period of time. And, you know, the revenues and all the other stuff can follow 2021 and beyond. So we actually feel like there's not only a great market opportunity for us, we actually think the staff members of our company feel like, you know, kind of is now our time to actually help many who are struggling to deal with this and to keep their employees employed. So we're pretty aggressive in the marketplace right now.
Yeah, I have to imagine, having seen your technology, that your door is being knocked on quite a bit for people to want to implement and want to implement as quickly as possible. Are you seeing that increase in demand or decrease in demand?
We are. But to tie it back to some of the opening comments, we're continuing to see what I'll generally call paralysis, which is a lot of smart people know they've got to make these pivots and shifts. They're doing their planning and their thinking and doing their syndication and stakeholder management, all of those natural things that ought to occur. So we're seeing sort of the early edge of companies that have worked through that decision faster, and they're stepping forward and they're trying to figure out the no regrets move. So that's for sure happening. A whole lot of other buyers are still trying to sort out, which is appropriate. They're trying to make sure they make the right decision and think it through. My encouragement for the most part is get through the decision cycle faster, because the realities are, right, as these pressures build, and, you know, we've got this really practical consideration of it's hard to interview and hire and bring on more staff when you're remote. So you get into all these really practical considerations that we try to advise the people we're talking to, which is like the faster you can get through the decision, the better, because everybody's struggling with a whole bunch of factors that nobody ever really planned for.
Yeah, definitely appreciate that. Dan, one of the questions I have for you is, when do you anticipate things to return to normal, and how are you preparing for a new normal? What's Euler doing from a sales and marketing perspective?
Well, that's, you know, a very good question, in the sense that we do expect this U-shaped recovery. We see some downside risks to it. But I saw another question there about you know, the U-shaped recovery, and I want to try and explain how that works, what the U-shaped recovery means. It's, you know, the second quarter is going to be really bad because we shut down all these businesses and shut down all the consumption. And just to make an exaggerative example, economists always look at growth rates. So let's say GDP was growing at a level of $10 before the recession came along, and then it dropped 90% to $1. Okay, you're at $1. You can get back up to $3 really easily, and you get a growth rate of 200%. You know, if you drop that low, you can really get big growth rates off a low bottom. That's why we expect to see a big bounce back, because we've fallen so far. You know, all of April was closed down, most of May, part of June is closed down. You know, it's a mathematical coming off of a low base. And it also brings up the question of recession. I'm going off a little bit, but I think it's important to know, you know, in the Great Recession, at some point, you know, it was over. And I was telling people the Great Recession's over, and people were saying, oh, really? Where is that? Because business conditions were still terrible. And I realized economists don't explain what a recession is. So a recession is when, think of it as the tide, you know, the tide is going out. The tide is receding, okay? When the receding stops, that's the end of the recession. You start coming back in. You're a long way from good. You're a long way from further back up the beach. But the receding part, the recession part is over. It's when things stop getting worse. Now, all that said, I don't, you know, in a sense, GDP, who cares if it's up 20% or 30% in the third quarter? I, you know, right now I don't care so much about that. I care about people going back to work. And that's going to take a bit longer for a number of the reasons I talked about. So we're not going to get back towards full employment, whatever, however you might define that, till easily 2021. And we went in with an unemployment rate that was a 50-year low of 3.5%. You're not going to see that for another few business cycles. I'm talking about decades. So it's going to be a while before everybody gets back to work, as many people as we get back to work to like. Maybe producing eventually the same amount of goods, but we need everybody going back to work. And it's going to be after 2021, I think. I think that was the basic question, right? Is when we get back.
You got it. Don't worry, okay. You nailed it. Sharon, okay. I saw you nodding your head on that. Could you have any closing thoughts?
I think, you know, I don't know what normal is, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that anyone knows what normal is at this point. I think that we're gonna have a new normal, right? And in this new normal, one of the things that Bluevine wants to take part in is the new banks. And what I think a lot of small businesses had felt during this COVID pandemic is that having an online bank and having access to their funds is crucial. And for years, small businesses were underserved when it comes to having an online bank account. It is available to consumers. I'm sure that Ray can speak to that. It's hardly available to small businesses, not in a simple and easy format. So what Bluevine is going to do next, we've already launched a product, but we want to enhance it and make sure that small businesses can really use it going forward as part of their ongoing business. So in other words, the new normal would have a lot of neo things. One of them is neobanks. And I think that that is the new trend in the US in general.
Well, I really appreciate that. Anybody else have any closing thoughts on that?
I'll offer two comments. I actually think 30 days from now, we could have completely different answers. I think this tragedy unfolding right now with these riots is like a tipping point nobody ever forecasted. So like for history majors, the assassination of the Duke in 1914, right? Nobody realized when it happened that it was a tipping point. So I do think there's a tremendous amount of volatility, and this could go away. Like hopefully a week from now, this settles down and the US comes back to normal. But it does seem as if you know, issue upon issue upon issue, you start to worry about, like, does the economy really buckle? Then the second point I would make is actually I'm super impressed with some of Sharon's comments. And I think the ability to move quickly and innovate and design answers that are specific to the moment in your market and your customers is going to separate. Like, we've been in so many conversations the last 3 months about what are the moments of truth. And it sounds like Bluevine, frankly, is sort of figuring out we got these specific moments of truth. We want to be there for our clients. I think that's going to matter a ton 6, 9, 12 months from now, because this is such a unique experience for so many Americans.
Absolutely. Well, I definitely want to be mindful of your time and our attendees' time, but also give some question and answer time. So Liz, I will shoot it over to you if you yourself have any questions, or do we have any questions on from the attendees?
Yes, we actually have three quick questions from early in the conversation. So we're going to backtrack just a little bit here. The first question is for Sharon. So you kind of touched on this a little bit, but the question is, did you give your entire portfolio a payment deferment, or was there a subset that you provided relief to?
Not the entire portfolio, but a material part of the portfolio. And in the last couple of weeks, we've started collecting again from some of these clients as things open up.
Perfect.
Could I make
a quick comment
about that deferment? You know, I think we all think it's the right thing to do under these circumstances. It's, you know, there's no question about it. We could make businesses go out of business, and it's going to hurt everybody. It's going to hurt them and our policyholders and our business. But deferring payments means it's deferring it to somebody else. Somebody else is going to have to eat it at some point. You know, it just doesn't go away. You know, if you're not getting the $10 back, eventually you're not going to be able to pay the next guy the $10. And, you know, it just is moving it along to somebody else. Like, you'll read about landlords giving deferment to, you know, and particularly the commercial side, they're getting stiffed for 50% of their rent. And that's, you know, supposedly a good policy. Landlords have bills to pay too. So it's the right policy for now. It can't last forever. It's just the economics basic. There's no free lunch.
Absolutely. So the next question is actually for Dan. So if you want to continue on, the question is, why are you expecting a U-shaped recovery when we really don't know when more accessible COVID testing or a vaccine will arrive? What's the inflection point you're looking at for the start of the upswing and recovery?
Right. So, I mean, that question is kind of predicated on the notion that we're not going to be recovering or growing until we have a vaccine in place. And I would suggest that we have a vaccine in place that certainly will boost economic growth. I don't think we have to wait for that though. And that's why I was talking about the sort of the numerical model of we fall from 10 to 1. It's really easy to go back to 3 and get a 200% growth rate, but you're still a long, long way from 10. So we expect the inflection point to be the third quarter. Like I say, you know, if I go through the months here, January, February, March, April totally shut down, May totally shut down, June half shut down. Well, everything that's possible to open back up is going to open back up in the third quarter. So, you know, we expect that to be the inflection point. And again, we don't expect to get all the jobs back anytime soon. So that's kind of, you know, the way we're thinking about it at the moment. And there's a big risk later in the fall of that COVID resurgence. So your question about the vaccine, yeah, that's completely relevant. But we don't think at this point we have to wait completely for that to boost economic growth.
Awesome. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate that. Liz, do you have one more question?
Yes, one last question, and then we'll go ahead and wrap quickly. Another one for Sharon. You mentioned adjusting your model. Is Bluevine expecting to begin to lend to customers in the near future?
The answer is yes, but very slowly. We need to be smart about it, but we also need to be accessible for our clients that need to reignite their businesses and need the funds to do it. Hopefully, those clients can also receive other government funds, and hopefully the PPP care would be adjusted such that it makes it easier for those loans to be forgiven. But the answer is yes.
Great. Well, thank you. Definitely want to be mindful of everybody's time. So thank you so much to all our panelists and speakers. Liz, thanks for taking care of the questions, and AccountsRecovery.net for helping to co-host this event. We will make sure that we get the recording up on AccountsRecovery.net, and the speakers will have their contact information available for additional questions. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.